One time I was speaking at a conference and they gave me the dreaded after lunch slot, you know, the 1 p.m. one where everybody comes back from lunch, and around 1:20 or so, everybody's like, so I said, I'm not going to fight it. I'm just going to speak in a low, kind of quiet voice like this and just kind of go kind of back and forth, kind of in a slow way. And then just whatever happens, happens at that point. So, no, but I admire you folks sitting and listening to three talks on a beautiful Saturday. It's admirable. I'm grateful. You know, I think one of the things that has excited me about this topic about heaven is just the anticipation of celebrating with God all of the great things that he's done throughout history. And if you look at the cycle of parables that Jesus tells in Luke 15, you don't have to turn there, but it's very familiar, in which Jesus is addressing why it is he spends so much time with the tax collectors and sinners, why he eats with them. Why does he eat with a guy like Zacchaeus, the chief tax collector, who must have been one of the most hated people in the nation of Israel? He was a chief tax collector. And you just think about what that meant. I feel like it's like a pyramid scheme where he's like more or less at the top of the pyramid. He's got tax collectors working for him. And he just was hated, but Jesus wanted to spend time with him. And he gives a defense for it in Luke 15 with the a cycle of three parables, the parable of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son, better known as the parable of the prodigal son. And as we look at that, all three of them focus on the celebration that happens when the person who has lost the thing finds it. The shepherd that leaves the 99 in the open country and goes after the lost sheep until he finds it, searches until he finds it. And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and returns home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." And the woman with the 10 coins, same thing. She lights a lamp and sweeps the house and searches carefully until she finds it. And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." And then, of course, the most famous, the parable of the prodigal son. It's the same story, but more complicated. And, you know, I've meditated about that. And again, we know in that there's a celebration, right? Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And so you look at that, and I feel like, I wonder how many celebrations that we've missed. Because we never knew about it, right? We never knew. You know, Jesus tells you, "I tell you, there is more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 sinners who don't need to repent. And there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." So I think if we actually do get a heavenly retrospect, we'll be able to join in the celebration that happened that time. But now in the future, we'll say, "I'm celebrating now because this is the first time I've heard about it." And to know about how God won this one or that one or the other to Christ, is it not every bit as worth celebrating now as it was then? Of course it is. It's just now, when we're in heaven, we'll be finding out about it. And we'll be able to celebrate. And it's going to be one after the other. And I think that's exciting. And what about your own salvation? What about your own situation? Right? I mean, think about it. What did God do to save you? Do you know everything that he did to save you? You really don't. All of the ways that God worked to preserve and to protect the gospel over centuries before you were even born, from all of the heresies that came and all the persecutions that came, to be certain that there was a gospel waiting for you when you were born. You don't know about that. And then the people who brought you to Christ, it might have been your parents, it might have been a college roommate, it could have been a campus worker or a youth worker, it could have been, I don't know. But all these different things that happen. And to be able to study the things that God did in you and around you to bring you to the point of conversion, it's amazing. And I think even those things, that's the conversion story you know the best. Part of the study that I've done here is to have the veil pulled back into the invisible spiritual realm. Like, what's going on around us right now? Think about it. We are working in a physical five-sense realm, the world of science, the world of the five senses of sight, of sound, of taste, the smell. That's the world we live in. But we know, as Christians, as Bible believers, that there's a spiritual realm around us too. Right? You remember that when Jesus was baptized in Mark chapter 1, we're told that the heavens were torn open. It's a very interesting verb. They were torn open. And out of that rending in the heavens came a dove. And the Spirit came down in the form of a dove and remained on Jesus. And it's a really amazing image because in the book of Isaiah, it's far more aggressive. In the book of Isaiah, it's far more militant, in which Isaiah cries out, "Oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down and make the mountains shake." He wants wrath. He wants judgment on the wicked of the earth. But at the baptism of Jesus, he rends the heavens and comes down like a dove on the Lamb of God. So it's such a picture of gentleness and love. And then the statement, "This is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased." How beautiful is that? But that rending of the heavens, it's like some kind of a veil or a membrane or a boundary or border between us and the spiritual realm. And we're taught about the spiritual realm, aren't we? We're taught that we're surrounded by spiritual force of evil in the heavenly realms. "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power," Ephesians 6. "Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." Now, how much of that can we see? None. We can't see it. We just know about it by faith. We know about it by good, sound Bible teaching. But we have a sense of the activity of demons in our lives. We're surrounded by demonic forces that oppose us. And as I was carefully studying and memorizing in the Gospel of Mark, I was amazed how many demon-possessed people Jesus heals in the Gospel of Mark. It's a very special focus in Mark. So he begins in the synagogue there in Capernaum, and a demon-possessed teenage boy comes, and he's foaming at the mouth and screaming, and, "What do you want with us, Jesus, son of David? And he says, "I know who you are, the Holy One of God." And they're crying out. He says, "Be quiet, come out of him." And he comes out. The demoniac of the Gadarenes called himself Legion. 6,000 demons. Who knows how many demons were in that person. One of them, I would say, in my opinion, that demoniac of the Gadarenes was the most wretched human being I've ever read about in this world. I can't imagine having a more wretched existence than him. He's a maniac. He's a murderous maniac. He's naked. He's cutting himself in stones. He's living in caves and tombs. He's breaking chains. Everyone was terrified of him. I can't imagine a worse life in this world. Hell is worse, but that's in the next world. In this world, I can't imagine a more wretched life than that. And it's so amazing how Jesus crosses after the stilling of the storm, and he crosses and lands in the Gerasenes, the Gadarene region there, and lands, and the demon-possessed man, when he sees Jesus, runs toward him. It's counterintuitive, because there's no doubt in my mind that they're afraid of him. The demons are terrified of Jesus, all of them, because they know who he is and what he can do. And so they come toward him and fall on the ground before him. And they plead with him, beg him not to send them into the pit to be tortured. So they're afraid of an intermediate punishment that he could send them there before the time. "If you come here to torment us before the time." And I find it interesting that they run toward Jesus. And the reason that it strikes me is they know there's nowhere to go. Where are you going to go? Is there some limit to his reach? No. He can get at them anytime. Do you remember the Syrophoenician woman that comes? Has a demon-possessed daughter. Jesus is there in Tyre. And she comes, and he ignores her. Remember that? And she continues to cry out, asking for mercy. And his disciples say, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." And he said, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." But this woman will not be stopped. She's a mother. Her daughter is tormented by this demon. She forces him to deal with her. Pleads with him. And he said, "It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs." "Yes, Lord," she said, "but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." It's an incredible statement. It's a lot of humility. Jesus was testing her, no doubt. If she had said, I'm not a dog, and I don't appreciate you calling me a dog, and walked away in her pride, she would have gotten nothing from Jesus. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And she humbled herself and said, yes, Lord. It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs, but even the dogs eat the crumbs. Couldn't there be some crumb that could fall to me? In Mark's gospel, he said, for such a reply you may go, the demon has left her, your daughter. So with my typical engineering mind, it's like, whoa, when did that happen? Well, a second ago. For such a reply, because you made that reply, I've told the demon to leave. Well, how did you do that? I thought it gone. And it's gone. And she went home and found her daughter healed and lying in bed. So the demoniac of the Gadarenes knew that there's nowhere to go. Or you think about the father with the teenage son who came down and was tried to get healed by the nine apostles that Jesus left when he was on the Mount of Transfiguration with Peter, James, and John, and they couldn't drive him out. I brought my demon-possessed son to your apostles, and they couldn't drive it out. And Jesus said, oh, unbelieving and perverse generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring your son here. And he threw him on the ground, foaming at the mouth. He said, how long has he been like this? Since childhood. He often throws him into the fire or the water to destroy him. Now you think what it was like to be the father of that boy. How many times he had to rescue his son, pull him out of the fire, out of the water. He was drowning. He had to dive in and save him. I mean, I can't imagine what that life was like. And it's interesting, in that one case, the only case I know in all four Gospels, Jesus said this to the demon. He commanded him to come out and never enter him again. Now, that's an interesting secondary comment, because Jesus said, actually, when an evil spirit comes out of a man and goes to arid places seeking rest and doesn't find it, then it says, I'll return to the house I left. And it goes in, and it lasts as worse than the first. But in that one case, he's not permitted to ever go back in that boy again. I think that's interesting. I like picture it like there's some kind of one of those tracing ankle bracelet things like on the demons. Like, I'm watching you. You know? I remember when I was preaching on the pigs, the herd of pigs, the demoniac of the Gadarenes sent out, and the pigs rushed down the steep bank into a lake and they're drowned. It's like, why does he give the demons permission? Because he's using them. He's controlling them, their motions and all that. He's using the demons for his own glory and his own purpose. He's given them freedom to do mischief. He's given them freedom to roam and cause trouble within certain boundaries and limitations. You remember in Job chapter 1 when Satan complains about the hedge? Remember that, the hedge? I heard a Christian comedian joking about that. Hedge? We need a wall. What's up with the hedge? You know? I was like, yeah, it's funny. I get it. But clearly, Satan was frustrated about the hedge. Satan was frustrated. He was complaining about the hedge. I guess what I get out of the hedge is that Satan, demons, can reach through and swipe at Job. We can't imagine that Job, in all those years he was alive, never had any difficulty in his life, never had any suffering, never had any loss. Of course he did. So Satan can take a swipe at Job through the hedge, but he can't get at him the way he wants to. Until God opened up a way for Satan to go at him. And he took everything he cherished in this life in one day, except his health. He didn't touch him the first time. And then he was allowed to take his health, but not his life. And so I believe that when we get to heaven, we're going to have all of the veil removed, and we'll be able to look back and see how the demons affected history, how the demons affected your life, how the demons affected this or that or the other moment in history. I've already alluded to it, but I want to zero in on it. One of the most significant moments in the history of the church is the moment that Martin Luther defended the Reformation doctrine, justification by faith alone, at his trial before Charles V at the Diet of Worms. All right, so he's there to defend. This is the very thing that had happened to John Huss 100 years before that. He was there under safe conduct and all that, but don't you believe it. When they condemn you, they'll kill you. And he actually fully expected to go and die. So he went there courageously. And they had all of his books on a table there. Martin Luther's books were on the table. and the papal legate that was cross-examining him and grilling him and all that said, "Are these your books?" "Yes, they are." "Do you now recant from what you've written?" And something came over Luther that day, and he, I don't know if his fear or what happened, he said, "Would you be willing to give me some time to think about my answer?" And it's like, "You've had plenty of time. You should have come here ready to give an answer." He said, "Would you give?" He said, "All right, we'll give you one night." So he spent that night in prayer. And I think there must have been so much spiritual warfare around Luther in that night of prayer. And again, in a mighty fortress is our God. And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, you know, he talks about, you know, the prince of darkness grim. We tremble not for him, etc. He was battling Satan that night. Because Satan would have liked nothing better, because Luther was very famous by then. Satan would like nothing better than cause him to buckle and to cave in and to just out of fear for his life. And I wonder what it was like for him and the demons that were allowed to kind of take a swipe at him and to kind of attack him. But God gave him strength, and then he stood the next day and gave his famous answer, "Here I stand, I can do no other, so help me God." What a great answer, one of the great moments. I have a picture of it framed on my wall in my office, hoping to be half as courageous or a tenth as courageous as he was at that moment for the gospel. But to be able to look back and see how the demons were working, do you imagine when Jesus ascended to heaven that the demons went out of business? Jesus said they're coming back worse than ever before. You think that they're not active here in Western, scientific, materialistic America? Oh, they're active. But we can't see them because we can't handle them. We can't handle knowing about them. They're hidden from us. Remember I said in Daniel chapter 10 that a good angel, a holy angel appeared, and Daniel couldn't breathe in his presence? He was on the ground, and he was there just as a messenger who meant him no harm. But do you remember also what the angel said? He said, "For 21 days I've been trying to get to you, but the prince of Persia stopped me." Now, who can stop a mighty angel like that but an evil angel? Maybe Satan himself. There is spiritual warfare going on every day around the nations, around individuals. And God hides it from us because, as Jesus said, "I have much to say to you, more than you can now bear." If you saw the warfare going on, you would not be able to function. You would not be able to live. You would not be able to breathe. You would be so filled with terror. As I wrote this book on Job, I had to come to the mysterious Leviathan at the end, this fire-breathing dragon. It's a weird thing. And you go, you get the study Bibles, and they're going to tell you, "Oh, this is the behemoth is a hippopotamus." And, you know, it's like, I've read all that. I was like, do you not see how weird this whole thing is? You got God boasting over inanimate creation, like the foundations of the earth and the sun and the moon and the stars and all that. And then he rolls out 10 animals, right? These 10 animals and talks about how amazing they are. And it does all this. And then Job repents. And effectively God says, "I'm not done. I want to talk about two more animals." That's just hermeneutically strange. And why is it that the book of Job begins with two chapters dominated by Satan, and then he disappears out of the story like he doesn't exist anymore? Oh, he exists. And what animal, what flesh and blood animal is so strong we can't defeat it? None. As a matter of fact, Psalm 8 tells us that he's put all of the beasts of the earth under our feet. So if you're going to tell me it's a crocodile, it's like, we win. Maybe I don't win. But someone wins, all right? There are people that know how to control. James said, every beast can be tamed and has been tamed by man. But not Leviathan. God said, you can't put a hand on him, you will not win. No weapon you forge will defeat him. It's got to be Satan. And so fundamentally then, I think what's going on with the hedge of protection is that I picture it like this complex maze, this massive maze, like the Pentagon, right? And the demons are running down the halls, and they come up to a doorway that doesn't open. They don't have the swipe card. They don't have clearance. But then suddenly, to the left, a door mysteriously opens, and they flood in and do damage. And then suddenly, mysteriously, it closes again. Who's controlling the gates? We know who's controlling the gates. God's opening and closing doorways for demons. And they're doing damage. They are doing real damage. A thief comes to steal and kill and destroy, but God's controlling it and using it. And we are going to marvel when we get to heaven about how he's done that. He's using them. He's using the demons. He's using Satan. So think of it this way. In the end, when all's said and done, if you could talk to Job years later about all that, what would you say Job's perspective? It was a hard time, hardest of my life. But I've never been in a stronger place spiritually. When God spoke to me out of that whirlwind, when I repented, when I put my hand over my mouth, it was the greatest moment of my life. So what did Satan gain by all that? Nothing. Because he said, if you take away all the stuff, he'll curse you to your face. He didn't. He was stronger than ever before. And so God is using Satan and demons, and he's sovereign over all of them. But we can't handle full disclosure right now. Instead, we get teaching like you're getting right now. You get sufficient information to know. And you are taught about Leviathan, and you're taught, even if Leviathan isn't Satan, it doesn't matter. You got Job 1 and 2. And you're told very clearly there that Satan does damage to the people of God on earth. He causes diseases. He causes sorrows. He causes losses. All of those things. And you can't do anything about it. But you are told in Ephesians 6 to put on your armor and stand your ground and to fight for your soul and for the health of your soul and to fight in prayer and to pray and to keep advancing the gospel. But I'm going to be excited when I get to heaven to see how God used Satan and demons for his own purposes. And then threw him into hell forever. He says in Romans 16, the God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. And how awesome is that? So I think that's part of our heavenly retrospect. We're going to get there and we're going to find out how your prayer life was hindered by demons. You know, my daughter, Carolyn, she said, Dad, I went through a lot of suffering and sorrow because I was a pastor's kid. Thank you very much, Dad. Appreciate that. No, she did. She thanks God for me being a pastor. But she said, I really believe it was because you're a pastor that I went through a lot of the psychological, emotional sorrows that I went through. I think she's right. I think my family suffered, and I suffered because I was a pastor, because you have a target on your back. And so fundamentally, Satan's going to come after us, but God protected us, and he's continuing to protect us. So to me, I think it's going to be cool to see how the kingdom of Christ was built against overwhelming opposition and powerful opposition, like the strong man with his armor and his weaponry and all that, fully ready for a battle, and then someone stronger comes along and strips him of his armor and plunders his house. That's Jesus stealing all of us from Satan's dark kingdom. That's going to be exciting. So we're going to see that. One final aspect before I talk about rewards I want to share with you. I believe one of the purposes of heaven will be to finish our education in evil. All right. So what do I mean by education in evil? Do you remember that tree, the forbidden fruit in the garden? Do you remember it had a name? What was it? Tree of the knowledge of good and evil. All right, putting it all together, we signed on for an education in evil. And good, I know, but they already knew good. So, oh, you want to know evil? All right, let's roll up our sleeves and do it. And God went with it. He went with it. Say, all right, we'll do it that way. It's not like it was any new idea. This is exactly part of his plan. It's like, you want to know evil? I'll show you evil. So what has evil been like? Well, the next chapter, a brother killed his brother. And within a few chapters, the hearts of human beings were only evil all the time, and a whole worldwide flood came. So what do you learn about evil there? Man, it metastasizes, it multiplies, it grows, it doesn't stay put. It just keeps going and going. And we've had 6,000 years of studying evil. God's idea is to draw the monster out, like some creature of the Black Lagoon, and lift it up, dripping of nasty stuff, and say, this is evil. Do you see it? Draws it out so we can look at it and we can know it and we can hate it like he does. So when I get to heaven, I will be so done with sin and evil and wickedness. Does that make sense? Not just in my own life, but in the world. I want to be in a world free from evil. So someone asked me a very insightful question about the possibility of a future fall from the grace of heaven. Like, Satan was a perfect being at one point, Lucifer, right? And he fell into sin. Isn't it possible that we might fall into sin? The answer is no. It's impossible. Why? Because the Word of God says this. Listen to these words. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. How about this? Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Or how about this? Revelation 22:5. There'll be no more night. They will not need the light of the lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever. So is there a future fall into wickedness for those people? No. Forever and ever. But here's the question. We've been learning about a dynamic education in heaven of things that we didn't know on earth. That will include our knowledge of evil. Will our knowledge of evil be related or unrelated to the fact that we will not fall into future sin? It must be related. Why will we not fall into future sin? Because we have learned what it is. We've learned what evil is, and we, of our own free will hate it like he does. Now think of it this way. Isn't the essence of our salvation to be conformed to Christ, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers? What does conform to Christ mean except that we think like him and love like him and act like him and have a resurrection body like him? Well, what does it say in Hebrews 1:9 about Jesus? He loves righteousness, but that's not all. He what? Hates wickedness. Will we hate wickedness in heaven? Yes or no? Let me ask again. Will we hate wickedness in heaven? Yes. Yes. How can we hate what we don't know about? We will know about wickedness, and we will hate it like he does. I read a story some years ago that illustrates this point, and it's pretty cool. It was one of the Arabian Nights stories. Do you guys ever read those? Like Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves and all that, and Aladdin's Lamp and all that. It's interesting, interesting stories. This one's entitled, The Man Who Never Laughed Again to the End of His Days. It's an interesting story. It's about a guy who was born into an aristocratic family and then just squandered his wealth, kind of like the prodigal son a little bit. And then this other wealthy gentleman finds him just kind of laying about in the city square and sees that his clothing is that of a fine-born individual, but now he's fallen behind a hard time. So he wants to hire him. So he hires him, and he's there to care for a number of men, like 10 older men. And the conditions of him caring and living in that mansion and having all his food, clothing, and shelter provided is he needs to never ask any questions about what's going on there. Okay? Well, he goes there and finds out these men spend their entire days weeping, like all day long weeping. They're just crying, crying all day long. Not a very happy work environment, but, you know, he's going to serve them and care for them. And they were kind to him. And he grew to love them, but it's just they're weeping, and it's the one thing he is forbidden to ask about. Well, one by one, these 10 men all die off, and then the man who owned the house is on his last, in his deathbed, and he has made him his legal heir, and he's going to own the home and all that. But his curiosity is killing him. He's like, I don't understand why you, because he was one of them, why you and all these other men spend all day long weeping. Said, I told you never to ask me that. And I'm asking you now, just because I love you and care about you. Don't ask me why. Well, it's clearly this guy, this older man's last day on earth. He said, I got to know. He says, well, I'm not going to tell you. But there's a doorway, a secret doorway, hidden in the garden, in the enclosed garden where we were. If you find it and you get through there, you'll find out. But I'm begging you not to. Well, he dies, he comes into his, you know, but what's the first thing he does, right? He's looking and behind a bunch of, you know, vines and all, he finds a door, but it's got a lock, and then he finds a key nearby and he locks, and he goes down this long, 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 long tunnel, and he ends up weirdly at some beach somewhere, and he's just standing there not really understanding why, and then this huge, beautiful eagle comes and picks him up and carries him to some distant, distant island and is and lands there, and it ends up being this incredible place. It's like this Islamic view of paradise with the 50 virgins and all that. It's this, all this kind of thing. But he's got this kind of sultan life, and he's living this. But his wife, beautiful wife that he has in this incredible life, she says, there's a certain doorway in the garden there where we live. Don't ever go through that doorway. Well, how long do you think that lasted? Because he's thinking, well, I went through that last doorway, and it turned out very well. So, you know, he resists temptation long enough, but finally he just has to go. So he goes through the doorway and ends up going through a long corridor and ends up at a different beach. And then a different bird picks him up and brings him back to the first beach. And that's that. So you're there a long, long time waiting for the bird to bring him back, and it never comes. So he crawls back up the original tunnel and spends the rest of his life crying. What a depressing story. Andy, will you please link that in some way to the study? All right, well, I am linking it. It has to do with our education in evil. The question is there a possible future fall into sin? Not if you really know what that journey is going to look like. And we've been down that journey, haven't we? As a human race and as individuals. We don't need to go through that door. We have no curiosity about this matter. We're never going to sin again because we've known where that leads. And it led to the death of our Savior. So I believe that the consummation of our education in evil will be our security in heaven forever. And not only that, but the basis of our celebrating of the various attributes of God that we've talked about. Because of evil, because of the demons, because of our own wicked sin nature, because of all of that, God showed his grace and his power and his wisdom in an amazing salvation work. So I think that's the final thing. Now, the last topic I want to cover with you, and then we'll be ready for some, questions. I want to talk about rewards. If I could just say, fundamentally, I think that once you come to Christ, you should be living every moment of every day for rewards. You should be seeking rewards with everything that you do. And I understand that there's this tendency where you want to say, not to us, but to your name be the glory. I'm not saying that you shouldn't say that. I'm still saying you should live for rewards. So the thing is, you need to understand them properly. So let me just tell you what I think simply, and then I'll root it in Scripture. Fundamentally, rewards are relational between you and God. It's God sharing directly with you that he's pleased with your works, in a way that is so rich and personally shared between you. It's just something that you share with your Father. He gets the glory, you get the joy, and he honors you and says, well done, good and faithful servant, forever, about all of the things you've done. You should have as many of those as you possibly can in your life. It's the best possible way you can live your life. And so you should not be squeamish about rewards or shrink back or, like it's some guilty pleasure. Not at all. It should organize how you live your life. And we'll talk about that. But let's talk about what rewards are. First of all, God has commanded us to believe in rewards. It's not an option. Hebrews 11:6. Without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who diligently seek him. Two things that you must have if you're going to come to God. You must believe that he exists and that he's a rewarder of people who seek him. So you have to believe in rewards. Furthermore, Jesus has told us again and again that he will reward his servants. The most concentrated teaching on rewards is in Matthew chapter 6, the middle of the Sermon on the Mount. He says there, do not be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before others to be seen by them. If you do, you'll have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that you're giving maybe in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. So stop right there. If rewards are bad and we shouldn't want them, then why is he telling us how we can be sure not to lose our rewards, but instead to have rewards? Clearly, rewards are good things, according to Jesus. And when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites, failed to pray standing in the synagogues and the street corners to be honored by men. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who's unseen. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you fast, don't be like the hypocrites, for they disfigure their faces to show men they are fasting. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so it will not be obvious to men that you're fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And then he said, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. So I'm telling you, store up treasure in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So that's clear to me. Jesus wants you to store up treasure. How much? As much as you possibly can. And part of my job as a pastor is to try to make sure that everyone who intersects with my ministry, either you folks or my local church or anybody, that I enrich you as much as I possibly can for Judgment Day. I'm basically like your retirement planner. I want you to be really rich when you finally retire. And so the richness that I want you to have is in good deeds. I want you to store up treasure through your good deeds. Now, again, I said, before you come to Christ, you're only storing up wrath. A human being who hasn't come to Christ has no good works. They're not storing up anything but wrath. But once you come to Christ, then you can begin the process of storing up good works that very day. And so we need to store up treasure. So fundamentally, Jesus has commanded us to store up treasure in heaven, and so we must do that. Another passage on this, a very important passage, in 1 Corinthians 3, 12 through 15. Paul talks about his ministry there in Corinth. He said, by the grace God gave me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and now other people are building on it. But let each person be careful how he builds. For if any man builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he will receive his reward. If it is burned up, he will suffer loss. He himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames. So fundamentally, the rewards come after Judgment Day, when Judgment Day tests the quality of the work. Gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, and straw. Some things are of greater worth and greater value, but still survive Judgment Day. Other things are worthless, and they do not survive the testing of fire. So that just has to do with the home base there is a good preaching and teaching ministry in a local church, making sure that it's good, sound doctrine. But it's also in general, any Christian building the Church of Christ needs to make sure that what they build is built properly and well. But if you do, then you'll get a reward. All right, so what are the rewards? Remember I said yesterday there are three C's. Crowns, commendation, and capacity. Crowns, commendation, and capacity. So let's start with crowns, all right? What are crowns? They are emblems of honor and of authority. Honor and authority. So the crowns are given to honor somebody and set them apart as a person of prestige. And then they also represent authority, all right? So crowns. Emblems given to a servant. For example, Exodus 28:2, it says, make sacred garments for your brother Aaron to give him dignity and honor. So it gives him dignity and honor. Also, Esther 6:6, when Haman entered, the king asked, what should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Or again, 1 Thessalonians 2:19 and 20, for what is our hope or joy or the crown in which we will glory in the presence of our Lord Jesus when he comes? Is it not you? Indeed, you are our glory and joy. Paul also calls the Philippian church his crown. There is crown. So they are emblems of honor. All right. They also represent authority in the kingdom. Listen to this. Luke 22:28-30. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So that's authority given to the redeemed, sitting on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Also, you remember the centurion who had the sick servant at home? He comes to Jesus, and Jesus is going to go to his house to heal his servant. He said, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go when he goes. I tell that one, come and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. I'm kind of a middle-level guy. We got people above me, people below me. The people above me goes all the way up to Caesar. Below me all the way down to the simplest recruit, the simplest foot soldier. I'm in the middle. There's a hierarchy of authority. God delegates his authority to created beings. So archangels means ruler angels. Then there's regular angels who are not archangels. So even within the holy structure of the angels, there are powers and principalities and orders. So we should not imagine some purely egalitarian scene in heaven among all the redeemed. I think there will be redeemed people in authority over other redeemed people. But what won't be there is sin. There won't be any tyranny. There won't be any rebellion. All right. I worked for 10 years in industry. I've been around non-Christians in the work environment. You would not believe the amount of grumbling and complaining that goes on about the boss. All right? It goes on all the time. It's our nature. We're rebels. We don't like people telling us what to do, for the most part. And we're like, well, I'm glad we're going to be free of all that in heaven. You're not. All right? The only thing is, it's going to be done perfectly, and you will have no problem with it yourself. You'll be free of all rebellion, and you will recognize there is no authority except that which God has established. And you will not have any problem submitting to redeemed people who have authority over you. And so remember the parable of the minas? The guy with the 1 mina gets 10 minas. All right, it's like a chunk of money, kind of like a talent. And he says, because you've been faithful in this very little matter, take charge of 10 cities. What does that mean? Well, are there going to be 10 cities in the new earth? I don't know. I know there's at least one, New Jerusalem. But the fact is, I think there's authority structure in heaven. So the crowns represent delegated authority and honor. So crowns. We also have, of course, the 24 elders, and they have their crowns. And what do they do continually? Whenever they give praise, glory, and honor, and thanks to him who sits on the throne, they cast their crowns before him. What does the casting of the crowns represent? Giving to honor and glory to God. You're giving to God full credit for all of your rewards. So all of your rewards, Jesus said, apart from me, you can do what? Nothing. So everything you've been rewarded for is only giving back to God what was already his anyway. It's not in any way a separate thing apart from God. It's totally immersed in God, for the glory of God, by the power of God. The rewards are like that. They're immersed in Jesus. But they're still your crowns, and you'll get to cast them before the throne. Does that make sense? So that's what crowns are. The second is commendation. What do we mean by that? Praise from God. Praise from God. All right, we know that heaven will be all about praise for God. We'll be praising God continually. But commendation is also about praise from God. And this we get from, obviously, the most famous, I've quoted several times already. His master replied, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master," or come and share your master's happiness. Well, most Christians that are aware of that, and it's a very well-known statement, and people will say that, what I really want is, I want God to say to me, "Well done, good and faithful servant." But even then, I find it's interesting that they imagine he says it once, like on Judgment Day. It's kind of like the husband who said to his wife, "I told you the day I married you that I loved you, and if anything changes, I'll let you know." Well, that's not how it's going to be in heaven. It's like, "I told you on Judgment Day I was pleased, okay? If anything changes, I'll let you know." I think he's going to be forever expressing his pleasure to us concerning our good works. Well done, well done, well done. Not just once on Judgment Day, but a continued shared experience of the good work, which is pretty rich when you think about that. It's basically God as a good father saying to his children, "I'm pleased with what you did." He is that kind of a father, and he expresses pleasure in us. The question is, how much of your life should be pleasing to God? 50%? I know it's late, dear brothers and sisters. How about all of it? I would like every moment to be pleasing to God. Doesn't it say in Ephesians, find out what pleases the Lord? Find out what pleases the Lord and do it. And if he's pleased, you know what he'll do? He'll express it to you in heaven. So the question is, how much of your life do you want to be something that God praises? I would say you want it all. So therefore, I'm saying every single moment of your life you should be seeking a reward. Every moment, not some of it, all of it. You should be seeking to please him at every moment. And he, being a good father, will express it to you. Now, we know that none of our works are pure and perfect because we're not pure beings. We know that the flesh wars against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh. We got a lot of pride, a lot of ego. We understand that. A lot of times we're good at the humble brag, say, "Yeah, you know, it was no big deal what I did all, you know, getting everything ready for this event. It was no big deal. I really enjoyed it." It's like, look, God knows what you're doing. And we're all prideful in that respect. So he has to kind of purify our works and purge them of all of that. But he's still gracious, even though our works are never perfect, to still reward them. Isn't that incredible? And so the fact is, the praise from God comes. It says in 1 Corinthians 4:5, at that time each will receive his praise from God. That's clear, a clear verse on praise from God. Or how about Job 1:8? Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one else like him on earth. How would you like to hear God talk about you like that? That's pretty awesome. Now, Job's one of the great men of history. And I believe part of heaven will be people that were just greater than us, and we'll be praising them too. Why not? It's like Job's a great man. I'm saying it right now. So I don't have any problem. I'm not worshiping Job. I'm just saying he was a great man. He was blameless and upright, a man who feared God and shunned evil. I have no problem saying that. I have no ego about that. It's true. There are brothers and sisters who I will find out lived better lives than I did and suffered more for the gospel than I did. And I'll have no problem joining in along with God and honoring and praising them for the lives they lived, giving him full credit and glory for them. So I think that's pretty awesome. Again, Romans 2:29, such a man's praise is from God, not from men, but from God. So we deeply want God to praise us and speak that. And when he says, enter into the joy of your master, well done, good and faithful servant, let me tell you how much joy your good work brought me. Like when you went into your room and closed the door and prayed to me, who is unseen, that pleased me. I saw what you did. Nobody else knows about that. Nobody knew that you did that. You prayed for this sick person or for your pastor or for this missionary or for this situation that you heard about. I saw that you prayed. I remember. Well done. That's what Jesus means. Your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. You don't need to tell anybody about it. There should be a lot of secret good works in your life. Money given, deeds done, where you don't want to be noticed because you want God to praise you. Now, the last is the hardest to understand. That's capacity. What do I mean by capacity? The ability to appreciate God. The ability to sense the greatness of God and worship him for it. Okay? What is that? Well, first of all, fundamental to my entire presentation last night and here is God. Heaven is God. It's all about God. It's a God-centered place. The glory of God, what you get in heaven is you get God. So Genesis 15:1, after the battle with the kings of Sodom and all of that, and there's all this loot to divide up, and Abram didn't want any of it. Remember this? He's like, I don't want any of it. And then in Genesis 15:1, God said to Abraham, fear not, Abraham. I am your shield. I am your very great reward. I'm what you get. Which is a beautiful statement. So what do we get in heaven? We get God. Psalm 73 says this, whom have I in heaven but you, and earth has nothing I desire beside you. We get God. But how much of God can you take? How much of God can you actually absorb into yourself? How much of God can you appreciate? Not all of him. He's an infinite being. You will only ever be finite. Remember I said to you, you're never going to be omniscient. So the question is, what is your capacity going to be for God? How much of God will you be able to take in? Listen to this statement in Luke 6:38. Give and it will be given to you, a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Wow, what does that mean? The measure you use is the measure that you're going to receive. Wow, that's a big concept there. Think of God, therefore, as like an infinite ocean of glory, of the greatness of God. And different Christians are different size vessels. Like you could imagine a cup, like a Dixie cup, or like a 2-liter bottle or something like that, all the way up to bigger and bigger and bigger volumes, including a super oil tanker. And all of them 100% submerged in the Pacific Ocean. How much more ocean is there? Pretty much infinite. All of those vessels are how full? Completely full, 100% full. But they have different volumes. They have taken in different amounts of that infinite ocean of the greatness of God. So that's what I think when when Jesus says, give and it will be given to you, full measure, pressed down, poured into your lap, for the measure you use is the measure you will receive. Since we're not prosperity, gospel, health, and wealth people, I'm not Joel Osteen up here. I'm not telling you health and wealth. And what will you receive? You receive God. And the measure you use horizontally in serving others is the measure you'll get back vertically from God. That's how much of God you'll get to perceive and conceive of in heaven. So what that means is your heavenly experience is tied to your earthly life. Now, I believe all of those different vessels will be completely satisfied. Nobody up in heaven with any regrets. Zero regrets. Everybody full, but not equally full. Does that make sense? All 100%, but different volumes. And the rewards you get, we're already told, Jesus said, when you give a banquet, don't invite all your rich friends, because they're going to invite you back and you'll be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame, and you'll be blessed. They cannot repay you, but you'll be repaid, listen to this, repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. That's when you get paid back. And you get paid back with the measure that you used in life. How generous were you? How much did you give? How much time and energy and money and sacrifice did you give in service to God? So, if you want to understand this, all right, on what basis are the rewards given? Well, you remember how James and John wanted to sit at Jesus' right and his left in his kingdom? Remember that whole moment? That was quite a moment. Because they didn't have the courage to come themselves. They got their mom to do it. Because it was a nepotism thing. She was related to Mary and all that. I think they were cousins or something. So the mother comes and says, grant that one of these sons of mine may sit at your right and the other your left in your kingdom. You moms understand that. It's like, yeah, and I'll be so proud. Jesus didn't say anything to her. He looked right at James and John. He said, you don't know what you're asking. Can you drink the cup that I'm going to drink? What did he mean by that? He's talking about suffering. He's talking about the cross. Can you drink the cup that I'm about to drink? And can you be baptized with the baptism I'm about to be baptized with? And what did they say? We can. Well, he just said a moment ago, you don't know what you're asking. Well, they didn't know what they were saying either. But Jesus did say, you will indeed drink from my cup. You're going to suffer. But to sit at my right and my left is not for me to grant. Those belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father. So everything's all been worked out before the foundation of the world. So here's one thing I get out of that. We don't get to choose the level of suffering and all that that we have in our lives. Some people are positioned and predestined and prepared for greatness in the kingdom, like Adoniram Judson and Ann Judson and all that. And we're not at that level. We don't have those kind of providential circumstances. We just need to be faithful with the life we have. And most of us are going to live average lives in our hometowns and in our areas, holding down jobs and raising families and then dying at age 81 and going to heaven. That's most of us. And when we get there, we'll find people who sacrifice more. And we won't have any problem with it. We'll honor them. Does that make sense? But the fact is, the reward is given based on suffering. But then he called them together. Remember what happened? The 10 were indignant with James and John. You know why they're indignant? They wish they'd thought of it. Try to angle for position. And Jesus said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them and their high officials exercise authority over them? Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be what? Your servant. Whoever wants to be first must be your slave. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Put it all together. Drink the cup, that's suffering. Serve. Suffering service is the measure of greatness in the kingdom. That's what he's going to reward. And the more it costs you, the more of a sacrifice. Like remember the widow that put in the 2 copper coins? She put in more than anyone else. Why? Because of the sacrifice level. She put in all she had to live on. It's not an absolute scale. It has to do with what it meant to you. How hard it was for you. How much of a challenge it was for you. How difficult was that for you? He measures in that sense. He knows where you came from. He knows the family you were raised in. He knows what you've struggled with. He knows all of those things and what you were overcame. To him who overcomes, he gives these rewards. What you overcame, he'll measure that. And he sees everything and he's gracious and gives rewards. So the cup is suffering. Service is service, benefiting others. It's humility. And it's sacrifice. That's what he rewards. Does that make sense? There's a lot more I could say about rewards. But what you get is you get more of God. You get more of an appreciation for God. So the question I want to ask you now is, how much heaven do you want? Not how much do you want heaven. It's how much of heaven do you want? How much of a capacity of God do you want based on the way you live your life? So in the fall of 1722, Jonathan Edwards, who was 19 years of age, set down a challenging set of resolutions which would govern the rest of his life. Resolution number 22, listen to this. 19 years old when he wrote this. Resolved to endeavor to obtain for myself as much happiness in the other world as I possibly can, with all the power, might, vigor, vehemence, yea, even violence I am capable of or can bring myself to exert in any way that can be thought of. I want to live a full-on Christian life in this world so I can obtain as much happiness in the next world as I can. 19 years old. How we live our lives in this time will affect how we enjoy eternity. That's behind that resolution. He spoke of endeavoring to obtain happiness, of deeds done. He expects it will take everything he has to obtain maximum joy in heaven. He speaks of power, might, vigor, and vehemence as if giving every moment of energy, totally consumed at every moment, is what it's going to take, pouring out all of the power of his body and soul toward that end. He even speaks of violence. We know he means like Ephesians 6 violence, or beat his body and make it his slave violence. He's going to be violent toward himself, not in any weird, twisted way, but just keeping himself under self-control, and he's going to put on his armor and fight spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realm. Whatever violence it takes, that's what I want. And so Jesus promised in Revelation 22 and verse 12, "Behold, I'm coming soon. My reward is with me, and I will repay everyone according to what he has done." It's like at the end of the Bible. It's pretty plain, isn't it? So no, we're not justified by works, but we're justified in order to do good works. And those good works build the kingdom. And so I believe some saints will enjoy more rewards than others. Some saints will enjoy more glory than others. Some saints will enjoy more authority than others. Some saints will enjoy more of God than others. But everyone will be completely satisfied. So imagine that you're at a heavenly feast, and there's 100 different culinary genius dishes. And you bring a certain measured appetite to that table, and you eat until you're full. And you can eat of this dish and that dish and the other dish as much as you want, and there's limitless amounts in each dish. And at some point, you're done, you're full, you push away from the table. You're all set. You're satisfied. You're not jealous of others who have a bigger appetite, but there are others that just have a bigger appetite and a bigger experience of God in heaven. So I want to close with a story that I read a number of years ago. It was entitled, "How Much Land Does a Man Need?" It was written by Leo Tolstoy. James Joyce called it the greatest short story ever written. James Joyce is an Irish novelist. It was written by Leo Tolstoy, set in Tsarist Russia. It was about a merchant named Payam. And Payam was not satisfied with his life, with his level of wealth. And so he decided he wanted to gain more. And so he realized that he would never be wealthy if he didn't own land. He didn't own any land. He was a merchant, but he just needed to get land. And so he tried a lot of different things in the community where he lived to gain land, but nothing worked. Finally, he hears beyond the Ural Mountains, in a very wild area of Russia there, a tribe called the Bashkir people who were selling land at a very, very cheap price. Did enough research to find out it was all true. Sold everything that he had, went to the Bashkir region. He had 1,000 rubles to spend. And he got there and the chieftain met him and he talked through a translator and they're drinking tea and he's like, "Well, I hear you're selling land." "Oh, yes." And he said, "Well, I looked around. The land here is beautiful. Arable land. Oh, yes, some of the best around. Very fruitful. Black soil, it's just beautiful." "Well, what's the price?" He said, "Well, it's 1,000 rubles per day." He said, "I'm sorry, say that again? 1,000 rubles per day. What does that mean?" "Well, it's 1,000 rubles for as much land as a man can walk around in a day. But he has to begin and end in the same day. And if he doesn't finish his journey, he gets nothing. All right? But if he completes it, that circuit, that will be his land. He said, but a man can walk around a huge tract of land in a single day. And he said, well, then he'll have a huge tract of land for 1,000 rubles.
Yeah.
But you'll lose everything if you don't finish. All right. He's like, oh, I'm like in heaven. All right. So that whole night he can't sleep. He's so excited. He's already kind of toured around. He sees, you know, everything. And so he finds out, well, how does this go? He says, we're going to go to the top of this hill that overlooks the entire region. You can just look north, south, east, west, whatever direction you want to go. But I'm going to throw down my, the chieftain said, I'm going to throw down my cap. And you'll start there. But you have to make it back before the sun sets or you lose everything. He said, well, how will I mark the land? They said, well, we'll give you a shovel, and you just pile up dirt, and we'll see that, and that will be your mark. He said, okay. So he's up. He can't even sleep that night. Gets up and goes before sunrise, and they all meet him. And just as the sun rises, he takes his chieftain takes his cap and throws it down, and he starts out. Payam starts out, and he goes down the steep hill and starts traveling out in a certain direction. He's already kind of figured out generally where he wants to go. And as he keeps going and going, he's just about to make his first turn. I always picture it kind of like a baseball field. So he's going from home to first. And as he's traveling there, he's just about to make his first turn. And another 100 yards up, he sees this whole kind of orchard with fruit trees. Got to have it. So he keeps going in that direction. And this happens several times. And finally, he makes his first turn. But it's much, that first leg is much further than he ever thought it would be. But now he's getting worried because he's gone so much distance in one line. So he turns, and as he's traveling, he takes off his coat. He's getting hot. The sun's getting kind of high in the sky. So he decides to take a break and eat some lunch and refresh himself. Not long, drinks some water, eats something, and then gets up and keeps going. But he makes the second leg a lot shorter. But now, have you ever had a day like that where it just starts to, the clock starts to accelerate? All right, so he's like, it's past noon now, and the hours are flying by. And the third leg, he makes it almost as short as he possibly can. He knows he needs to get back to that hill. And he can see it, but it's in the distance. It's much further away than he thought it was. And now he's worried, and he starts to run. But as he's running, he's losing strength by the moment. Finally, he gets to the bottom of this steep hill, and the sun sets. And he's devastated. He's lost everything. He doesn't have anything left in the world. So he throws the shovel down and he just casts himself on the ground. But the chieftain and the other Bashkir people at the top, they call down. They say, we can still see the sun from up here. What are you doing? Get up. So he picks up the shovel and labors up that steep hill, that last stretch. And just before the sun sets, he dives and grabs the cap. And they cheer. They'd never seen anyone travel around so much land in a single day. Problem is, he's dead. Blood's coming out of his mouth and all that. And so they take the shovel that he carried around that, and they dug a grave for him, and that's the answer to Tolstoy's question. How much land does a man need? About 6 feet down and about head to toe. I told this to a Russian friend of mine. They said, you got to understand this about Russian literature. It's like everybody dies. It's so depressing, you know? Well, just like the Arabian Nights story, are you going to do something with that or what's the point? All right, the point is this. How much heaven do you want? I picture kind of the average American Christian getting up and kind of sitting in a recliner and looking out at the scenery with a shovel by the side of the recliner. And then going about 50 feet down and digging a tiny little hole and 20 feet over and another, and then going back up to the recliner and enjoying the rest of the day. It's beautiful scenery. It's like zero ambition for heavenly glory. So the question is, how much heaven do you want? How much of God do you want? I've presented my ministry in two journeys. I would commend two journeys to you. Grow in holiness and do evangelism and missions. Serve other people in the name of the gospel, in the name of the Great Commission, and grow in grace and the knowledge of Christ, and you'll have a great heavenly reward. That's the life that God wants. Put your sins to death by the power of the Spirit, grow in holiness, and serve other people with the gospel. So that's what I would commend to you.